Hello, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Jeff Parkinson. Today I'll be reading from the June 2024 edition of Psychology Today magazine. The first article is written by Hara Estroff-Morano and is titled Beyond a Fair Share. My husband hired a contractor to help with a project. I am in the same business as the contractor, but didn't get involved as I work full-time. The contractor is now out of business, and the project is incomplete. I am the obvious person to help, and I want to, but I'd like to see my husband put in more effort first. I'm busy with paying clients, which he resents. I resent that he has far more time than I do, but is unwilling or unable to advance on his own behalf. This is creating tension between us. I have encouraged him to recognize that he has the time and ability to proceed on his own. He just needs more structure around the tasks. Should I rearrange my schedule and deprioritize exercise and sleep to help him cross a time-consuming finish line? Life has a way of happening. Making sacrifices, even big ones, is part of a healthy marriage in which partners feel free to give each other what they need in a moment of difficulty, or even through an extended crisis. Goodwill evens the expectation that should a special need arise, your partner would similarly do more than his fair share on your behalf. In fact, the helping partner may not even see their act as a sacrifice, because they know they will, eventually, share in the rewards of goal achievement, whether tangible or intangible, and there is something to be gained from the process of pulling together on an important goal. Temporarily giving up what you need so that a partner can prioritize what they need can itself amplify a sense of connection. But this works only if there is the perception that you're both contributing more or less equally toward the goal. Otherwise, you invite resentment. You're so obviously the right person to step in to help your husband. You've got the skills and the desire, to say nothing of the easy commute. But before you double up on work, you need signs that your husband is doubling down. You're making the sacrifice of time, perhaps taking on twice your usual workload, so you rightly need to feel that you both have the same hunger for the project, and, most important, use your time with the same intensity. Absent quality of effort, everything falls apart. Resentment builds, eroding the emotional connectivity that made the joint effort possible in the first place. Resentment furnishes a negative filter that will soon color every other activity and suck the joy from everything beyond the project as well. You certainly don't need more to do, but it might be worth your while to become an undercover psychologist for a moment to understand why your husband is having trouble advancing on his project. You excel at the kind of work he must now do. That could be daunting to him, or anyone. Is there a fear of not measuring up, or of being judged? Or perhaps the structure he needs could be addressed with a few tips you've accumulated for overcoming the hurdles he now faces. Such a cozy transfer of expertise is one of the unsung benefits of marriage. The next article from the June 2024 edition of Psychology Today magazine is titled, Processing My Divorce, One Uber Ride at a Time. In the grind of the gig economy, connecting with passengers provided a respite. Written by Jonathan Rigsby. Things get damaged when you get divorced. When my wife Marie and I first separated, A coworker told me that marriage bound two people together, and any separation was going to involve a rending of flesh. I had expected it to hurt, but the aftermath left me emotionally shattered. I was depressed, anxious, and increasingly panicked by the shrinking balance of my bank account. I never expected the answer to my mental health issues and my financial problems to come from being behind the wheel of my car. I had a job as a crime intelligence analyst for the state of Florida. But after the divorce, I needed to pick up a second job to make ends meet. Uber made big promises that I could choose my own hours and be my own boss. Soon after signing up, I was spending most of my nights and weekends ferrying the rowdy undergraduates of Florida State University to and from their parties. Every time a passenger asked me why I had become a rideshare driver, I panicked. I could barely explain my job as the taxi man to my 2-year-old son, Alex, much less a car full of strangers. I practiced telling the story. I'd moved to Tallahassee with my girlfriend so she could get her graduate degree. If they asked if we were still together, I'd tell them that things hadn't worked out. Then I'd change the subject. Or I'd lie and simply pretend to be someone else. With my baby-faced appearance, people often assumed I was in my mid-20s. They asked if I was a student at the university, and at times I went along with it. I was a graduate student in meteorology, you see, trying to find a better way to detect tornadoes. I was an accountant for a local business, drumming up some extra cash. I was a full-time driver, an aspiring stand-up comedian. Anything was better than the truth. I explored all the people I might have been if I had lived a different life. I tried on the identities of people whose lives hadn't gone awry, people who were successful or striving or hoping. I told strangers that I was saving up for a vacation, that I was going to backpack across Europe or visit a Japanese hot spring. Every passenger became an opportunity to imagine a better life. This chameleon act was useful for the nights when I couldn't bear to think about my situation. Those were the nights when I took my old wedding ring out of the box in my closet and slipped it on for the night. When passengers asked what brought me to Tallahassee, I could answer their follow-up questions about whether I was still with my girlfriend by tapping my hand on the back of the headrest to show off the golden band. The college girls found this particularly thrilling, and I basked in their adoration at my commitment. When they asked why I was driving, I told them I was earning extra money for the down payment on our dream home. Deep down, I knew what I probably needed was a good therapist. But the insurance I had through my day job covered a limited pool of providers. Some required me to pay upfront and submit receipts for reimbursement through my health insurance provider, an extra step I had neither the time nor the free cash flow to pursue. With money in short supply, the best I could do was connect for a brief moment with the strangers in my back seat. They would talk to me about their lives, and I could offer them my advice. I could draw on my own experiences to try to solve their problems. Eventually, I could test out talking about my own situation. On weeks when I was strong, I would test my limits by telling people more of the truth. I would let my emotions peek out little by little. As passenger after passenger asked me why I had become a driver, I was forced to confront and desensitize myself to the pain of admitting that I was divorced. Even saying the words, "I'm divorced," out loud, was enough to make my emotions well up inside me at first. But after months of practice, I became accustomed to saying the words and watching for a reaction. Most people gave some measure of sympathy, and a few told stories of their own. Middle-aged men usually took it as an opportunity to talk about their own divorces, while women wished me happiness for the future. No one gave me the harsh judgment that I felt I deserved, and eventually I was able to convince myself that perhaps I shouldn't think of myself as a total failure. It wasn't therapy, but it was something. With no place to process what I had gone through, I dealt with my emotions behind the wheel. It was a place where I was in charge, where I was both literally and metaphorically in the driver's seat. The reactions of the college students were by far the most comforting. While older men would sometimes rant hatefully about their exes, and couples would awkwardly change the subject, the students simply accepted me. At times, their own lives were as complicated as mine. This was the case near the end of the academic year, when I picked up Sandra and her friends. The three girls were dressed in sparkling gowns, clutching small purses, and wobbling in heels that were too high for their level of intoxication. As I watched them stumble toward the car, I slipped my ring off and stashed it in the center console. They looked friendly, and I assumed I wouldn't need my golden talisman's protection from a group of sorority girls on their way to some sort of formal event. Sandra climbed into the middle of the back seat, taking a moment to scoot the shimmery fabric down as she settled in between her friends. Mere moments after they piled in, the predictable questions started. Was I from Tallahassee? How long had I been driving? Was I still with the girl who had brought me to the city? I took a moment to breathe before telling them that we had gotten divorced the previous year. "Oh, my parents are divorced," one of the friends chimed in. The other nodded sagely beside me and told me that hers were too. And it had turned out okay. As her friends told me that it was too bad and they were sorry for me, Sandra chose a different route. "Did you guys have any kids?" she asked. "Yes," I said, tapping the home button on my phone to show off the picture of Alex that served as my background. Sandra's friends cooed that he was cute. "Just make sure that he knows you still love him," she said. Sandra went on to say that her parents were divorced, and she had been dealing with their fighting about who would come to her graduation. Two grown adults despised each other so much that they couldn't bear the sight of one another for even a few hours to celebrate the accomplishment of their child. She said it was yet another episode in a long line of one-sided holidays where she'd had to play peacemaker. As she spoke, her friends passed her tissues to save her from smearing her eye makeup with her tears. "Most of the time, it's not so bad. It was only a big deal at, like, Christmas. That's when I really wished we could have been together." I told her that I wasn't going to have that sort of relationship with Marie. Even if we weren't together anymore, I didn't want us to be enemies. I'd never wanted that, not for us or for Alex. I hated the middle-aged men who spoke scornfully of their ex-wives. No matter what had passed between us, Marie was my son's mother, and that alone made her worthy of respect. Sandra told me that she wished her parents could have had my attitude. Perhaps that was the reason she had joined the sorority in the first place, to try to find the sense of family that she had lacked as a teenager. I dropped the young women off at the colossal brick stadium of FSU for whatever formal event was being hosted there. My next ride was already waiting for me a few blocks away. As I rolled up, I looked down at the center console and thought about the ring inside. I wondered about Alex, asleep at the house. Did he miss me when I was out working? Did he wake up wondering where I was? Would he tell his friends that his parents were happier apart? Or would he pine for us to be together again? I looked down at a black stuffed bear that sat in my cup holder, a toy from a McDonald's Happy Meal. It had come from a promotion for endangered animals. I carried it with me in the car as a symbol of Alex. Ever since he'd been born, he'd been my little bear. The stuffed animal was my way of taking him with me wherever I went. I picked up the little bear as I waited for my passengers and thought about Sandra's words. It's only a big deal at like Christmas. I sure hoped so. The next article from the June edition of Psychology Today is titled "The Infidelity Paradox: Why Do People Cheat Even If They're in Happy Relationships?" Written by Noam Spencer, PhD. Why do people cheat in their relationships? Popular arguments include that people who have affairs feel neglected by their partner, are unhappy or angry with their spouse, or have otherwise fallen out of love. New research presents evidence for a simpler answer. People may have sex outside of their relationship just because they want to have more sex. Social psychologist Dylan Selterman of Johns Hopkins University and colleagues surveyed registered users of the website Ashley Madison, which facilitates extramarital affairs, unmarried partners included. Interesting findings include a lack of guilt over having affairs, a feeling that cheating did not have anything to do with how much individuals love their spouse, and the expectation that an affair would not affect the quality of their primary relationship. In this study, two groups of participants completed surveys 3 months apart. A smaller third sample was matched across the two occasions, allowing for some longitudinal analyses. The first group included 810 respondents, mostly men, with an average age of 51, in a committed relationship. The second group contained 868 participants, also mostly men, of similar age and relationship status. The third sample included 234 similar participants. Selterman and his colleagues asked the participants questions about infidelity, including their history of affairs, enthusiasm about finding affair partners, the quality of their relationships, and their affair, both sexually and emotionally, their satisfaction in life, their level of regret, their motivation for seeking an affair, and more. Most participants had had affairs before. This was, after all, a study of people using a website that facilitates affairs. But infidelity is common among the general population as well. Estimates show that 20-25% of married people and 33-50% of young adults in relationships have affairs. According to those in the study, the quality of their relationship was not a significant driver of their desire for an affair. Moreover, relationship quality did not decrease as a function of having an affair, they reported, nor did it make divorce more likely. Most participants reported that their partners did not know about the affair. In terms of life satisfaction and self-esteem, those who cheated did not score differently from those who remained faithful, researchers found in the 3-month follow-up. Sexual needs, rather than relationship needs, appear to drive the desire for affairs in this study. Approximately half of the participants across the samples said that they were not currently sexually active with their partners. Sexual dissatisfaction in their relationship was the number one reason people chose to look for affairs. Other commonly cited reasons included low commitment to one's partner, wanting autonomy, and a desire for a variety of sexual partners. These findings contradict both previous research and conventional wisdom. Existing research in the field has hypothesized a deficit model of infidelity, which assumes that cheating is often a result of problems in a relationship. Moreover, it is commonly assumed that those who commit infidelity will often be dogged by a guilty conscience and emotional upheaval because of their transgression. Indeed, among the least endorsed reasons for wanting an affair were feeling a lack of love towards one's partner, anger with one's spouse, and feeling neglected, according to the study. Participants also reported that they enjoyed their affairs, both physically and emotionally, and had few regrets about their infidelity. How can people feel both happy in their relationship and willing to cheat on their spouse? One reason may be that the relationships of the cheaters resembled those of the non-cheaters. Those who had affairs did not report having worse relationships and did not behave differently in their relationships compared with those who remained sexually exclusive. Those more satisfied with their relationships felt no more regret over their infidelity than those less satisfied. Further, as mentioned, cheating without being caught didn't affect the quality of the relationship, according to the study's participants. To be clear, the study has several limitations. For one, it is based on self-report, which is often prone to inaccuracies, particularly when sexuality is concerned. Moreover, the sample is skewed toward middle-aged heterosexual males, which may not be representative of the general population. Many participants reported ambiguity about the exclusivity status of their relationship, which may further muddy the results. Finally, the participants were found through the Ashley Madison website. That may make them a significantly distinct cohort compared with the general population. Still, the results suggest that infidelity may be more psychologically nuanced than previously believed. Marriage and long-term relationships come with compromises and trade-offs, and many marriages are painful. The data suggest that we may want to question some common assumptions about links between infidelity and relationship quality, and about moral consistency in intimate relations. In the end, relationships and the people in them can be complex. Humans often behave in ways that contradict both conventional wisdom and common sense. We can also be quite simple. Sometimes the sex is just about the sex. The next article is titled One Question for Alua Arthur, A Guiding Light at the End of Life, written by Abigail Fagan. Alua Arthur is a death doula. She provides existential, emotional, and practical support to people who are dying. She came to this work through a dark chapter in her own life. She struggled with depression, reflected on her own mortality, and experienced the passing of her beloved brother-in-law. By exploring death and learning to help others through it, Arthur built a new life, rooted in authenticity, honesty, and purpose. She shares her story in the new memoir, Briefly, Perfectly Human. Question: how do you support people through their fears of death? Answer: I practiced law for almost a decade, and I grew terribly depressed. I took a medical leave of absence and went to Cuba. On the bus, I met a young woman who had uterine cancer, and we had the richest, realest conversation. What became clear was that there wasn't any space for her to talk about dying and her fears around it. Her psychiatrist only wanted to talk about living with disease. Her family and friends would steer her back toward hope, healing, and living. It was limiting, and it was unfair that she couldn't talk about death because of other people's discomfort. People's fears around death fall into four major categories. 1. Pain, fear of the process of the body. 2. The unknown, what, if anything, happens after death. 3. Loss of control. And 4. A life not fully lived. It's not my job to help people get over their fears of death. That's a deeply existential journey that every individual must take on their own. My job is to sit alongside them as they work through it. But there are still some things I can offer. When their fear is about the process of the body, we talk about pain management, hospice care, and needs at the end of life. When they question the unknown, I help them get clearer on their belief system. For the fear of not having lived fully, I support them in understanding the thing that's missing. There was a client who hadn't left the bed in months, but she still wanted to dance and perform. She couldn't do it, so we looked at ways to be it. We looked back at the life she created. When she moved or talked, everything about her was poetic and lyrical. It took a while, but she realized that she already embodied what she sought in dance. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 2024 edition of Psychology Today magazine. I'm Jeff Parkinson. So long until next time.